long time there was some kind of hunt going on. People wanted to find a world one with me for M2 brains. But there were many people for a while who thought that this would not be possible for various reasons. And for example, in 2004, Schwartz showed a no-go theorem. So he showed that it would not be possible to find an action with all the right symmetries if you base this on a UN H group. Okay, but then there was some work by Berger, Lambert, and Gustafsson. They actually managed to write down a Lagrangian based on an algebraic construct known as a free algebra, which indeed had all the right symmetries to describe M2 grams. It had always be H4 super conformal invariants and parity invariants. Okay, so then it looked good for a while, but then people started looking more carefully at this theory, and they looked at the moduli space, and they found that at best this theory could only describe at most two M2 grains. And even for two M2 grains, there were some problems. Okay, so these problems were then solved by Aharon, Bergman, Efres, and Malasiena with the KVDM model, which is the UN times UN quiver transignment stage theory, and which is the correct description of M2 brains. Okay, so what is ABDM theory? So this is just, to me, this is a summary of the field content in ABDM theory. So you have gauge fields, and then you have some metro fields, you have scalars and fermions. So in a little bit more detail, I'll not spell out the entire action, but basically in a superspace formulation, you have various parts. You have a transignment part, because you don't have any kinetic terms for the gauge fields, so instead you have transignment terms. Then you also have some metro part, which contains the kinetic terms for the metro fields, and then you have some potential. And this action is written down in terms of the superfields in this theory, so you have gauge and metro fields. So you have two superfields, set A, which are in the bifundamental of this quiver H group, and then you have two WAs, which are in the conjugate representation. Okay, and then just a few words about what ABDM did to fix the BFG model. So basically what we did was to change the superpotential. So something that we did in my paper together with Bernard Kibanov and Klose in 2008 was to write down in this formulation the BFG superpotential. And what you can see is that it makes use of this double dagger notation, which has a definition here where you actually conjugate the SU2 representations separate from SU4, and this is actually only possible to do unambiguously when the rank of the gauge group n is equal to 2. So in this formulation, this is what the obstruction towards generalization to higher rank gauge groups amount to. Then there were also some other formulations of this Berger-Lambert theory, and this obstruction appears in the other various formulations as well. For example, in the original Berger-Lambert formulation, you had a free algebra and then also a consistency condition, which was a fundamental identity. And at first it was believed that probably it has many solutions, but then it turned out that it actually has only one unique solution, SO4, which is equal to SU2 times SU2. And that means that it's at most two M2 grains. Also, the fact that it's SU2 times SU2 indicates that it may not even be the proper theory for M2 grains, because what ABDM showed was that you actually have, they are missing U1 factors, which are actually important to get the moduli space right. Okay, so I mentioned that there was also an SU2 formulation by which van Ramsdonk wrote down, and in that formulation the obstruction appears in a similar way as here, because he has a reality condition on the scalars, which he uses in the Lagrangian, and again that reality condition only makes sense for n equals to 2. Okay, and then I also mentioned here that there are different global symmetries for these superpotentials and indeed higher series. Okay, so now that we have this ABDM model, I just wanted to put it in the holographic context. So again, the ABDM model is a human transient equivalent transcendence gauge theory, and it describes, it is supposed to describe an arbitrary number of two grids. This is the claim. And the gravity dual is M theory on 8S4 times the 7 mod set K. So in the holographic context, and it means that when the two coupling is small, we have this ABDM theory description field theory, and when the coupling is large, we have a supergravity description. And now exactly what supergravity description you have depends on how large A you have, because effectively this 7 sphere you can write it as CP3 times U1. So if K is sufficiently large, then effectively this U1 is cancelled out, and you're left with 2A theory, 2A string theory on A is 4 times CP3. Okay, so that's the claim. It's the right theory. So I'll just mention a couple of things which support this claim. So for example, I mentioned earlier the moduli space, which wasn't really possible to match to the Berger numbered Gustafsson theory. So in this case, it actually works, and the way it works is that to find the moduli space, you should have vanishing potential. And this is actually, this works if you have diagonal matrices, because then you can commute them at will, and you can make various terms in the potential vanish. So then the naive expectation then, if that's the moduli space, is that you have the diagonal elements, and you have two scalar components of the Z superfield, and two scalar components of the W superfield. So you have four matrices, N diagonal components in each of them, and they are complex. So it seems like the moduli space is C to the power 4L. Okay, and that is partially right, but not completely, because there are residual gauge transformations. So what you can, and these residual gauge transformations are gauge transformations which preserve the diagonal nature of these matrices. So you can act with U1s from the left and from the right on each of the diagonal elements, and you can also permute the diagonal elements. So the conclusion then, if you take this into account, is that the modular space is C4 mod set A to the power capital N, and then modded out by this permutation group. And this then leads to the interpretation that this theory, it is consistent to claim that this theory describes N M2 grains on a space with a set K singularity. And the set K, the orbital action is the one that I showed here and follows from the residual gauge transformations and how they act on these scalar components. Okay, so that's one piece of evidence which is in support of this claim that the ABDM model is correct here. And another piece of evidence that I'll mention is a supersymmetry analysis. So from the gravity side, what happens is that, okay, again, you have this ZK orbifold. So you can count how many components of the spinner that are preserved by this orbifold action, because it breaks some symmetry. So what you can see here is that you have M2 grids, so you have 8 transverse coordinates. So you can form 4 planes out of those 8 coordinates. And then you have spins, S1, S2, S3, and S4, corresponding to those 4 planes. So what you can see here is that if you have exactly 2 spins up and 2 spins down, then S1 plus S2 plus S3 plus S4 is 0. So then you have preserved components, and it's possible to choose. So that means that 6 of the components are preserved. So in general, you have n equals to 6 supersymmetry. But then one thing that you can note is that if k is sufficiently small, if it's 1 or 2, then it actually works if all spins are up or all spins are down. Then you will also have preserved components, 2 more possibilities. So that means that you have maximum n equals to 8 supersymmetry. So this is then a prediction from the gravity side that you should have this supersymmetry enhancement when the level of the transimons group or order of the orbital group k is equal to 1 or 2. Okay, but that's all there is, because there is nothing more, because you are subject to a Pirelli condition of this type. So if you have precisely one spin up or precisely one spin down, then that will not be enough. Okay, so that was the gravity side. And then on the field theory side, what happens is that in this superfield, in this superfield combination, you generically have U1 R symmetry, but if you're supposed to, if this claim is that you have n, really have n equals to 6 supersymmetry, then that should correspond to SU4 R symmetry. So the question is whether we can see that manifested in the action of this theory. The first thing to note is that there is an SU4 multiplet which is preserved by the orbital action, by the way in which these residual gauge transformations act on them. And then the claim is that the symmetry, the action is actually invariant under this SU4, which mixes R charges in general ways. So the full R symmetry is actually SU4, which then corresponds to n equals to 6 supersymmetry. So to complete the proof, you have to show that the action actually has this symmetry, this SU4 symmetry. And AVDM already did it for the bosonic part of the potential. They broke down, in terms of this SU4 multiplet, a manifestly invariant potential. So then another thing that we did in my paper together with Bena Kevanovic also was to complete this argument by writing down the fermionic part of the potential as well in this manifestly SU4R metric way. Okay, and then if you prefer, a month later, Schwarz actually found the explicit supercharges. Okay, so this is then the rough form of the full action of the ABM model. So you have two transimons terms, and each transimons term is not parity, actually breaks parity invariance. So it gets a minus sign under the parity operation. But then what happens is that you have two transimons terms, so you're supposed to interchange A for A ahead under the parity operation, and then the sum of the two transimons terms is actually parity invariant. And then you have kinetic terms and potential terms. So as I mentioned, this form of the Lagrangian actually has all the symmetries manifest, OSP, CX4, and parity invariance. So this is the model that I will continue to discuss. Okay, so first I will talk about the free energy. So just the motivation here for why I chose to look at this particular property of AVDM theory. I mean, when you have this new field theory, which was completely unknown earlier, then the question was, what are the unique features which you can study with this model, but not the previous examples of AVS CFT? And I don't know, here is a list which you may agree with or disagree with, but this is kind of the list of unique features and interesting properties of the AVDM model, as I saw it, that could possibly be interesting to use it for. So it's a one volume theory for two brains. You can imagine using the field theory side for studying condensed matter systems, because there may be three-dimensional systems with transimons terms which have appropriate conformal fixed points. Also the four-dimensional side of the duality could possibly be used to study could possibly be used in the cosmological context to study various string backgrounds, which are ADS, so they have the wrong sign of the cosmological constant, but still it could be useful for some purposes. Then another property of these theories, the monopole operator, which is something which is unique in the holographic context, the importance which appears to be assigned to the existence of these monopole operators. because I mentioned that on the gravity side, it is straightforward to see this supersymmetry enhancement. So n equals to 8 when the level of the overfolding group is k is equal to 1 or 2. On the field theory side, it seems like it's much more difficult to see this enhancement. And it appears that these monofold operators would be important to understand this. And there was some on this. Okay, and then spin chains and integrability are is always a field which is important. So, I mean, it would be interesting to see how those features work in this theory and, for example, whether ABGM theory is integrable or not. Okay, and then there are also unique scaling properties which appear in ABGM theory. There are various objects which have a strong coupling scale as lambda to the power minus 1/2. And so this is related to strong suppression of the available degrees of freedom and strong coupling for some reason. So the entropy goes to zero, and there are various objects which exhibit this behavior. And this is then basically the problem that I was particularly interested in and have been looking at from various points of view. For example, the canonical object to study this by looking at the free energy. So that's the motivation for me why I wanted to look at this. Okay, so here is just some words about comparing this to the usual Supriang-Mills case and what happened in that case. So if you have a free energy theory, a finite temperature field theory, then that's supposed to be due to a gravity theory where you have black holes. And then just some words about what happens in Supriang-Mills. So first of all, people did this free energy computation, including quantum corrections in Supriang-Mills, and they found that the quantum corrections that they got were consistent with the existence of a smooth interpolation between the weak and strong coupling limits of the free energy. They were the answer was a constant at both ends, but it was a different constant. Another interesting thing which happens in Supriang-Mills is that if you're doing the true free energy, then you get into trouble with infrared divergences. So what happens is that the leading order correction is of order lambda, and that's actually good. But then the next leading order correction actually exhibits, it's actually order lambda to the 3/2, which looks very strange in a curvature expansion, but the reason is that you have to circumvent these infrared divergences in some clever way. So you have to reorganize perturbation theory, and in the end it turns out that in Supriang-Mills leads to this non-analytical dependence on the coupling constant. So then some interesting things in ABGM theory would be then to see similar phenomena appear in this case. For example, this reorganization of the perturbation theory corresponds to screening of scalars and gluons in the Supriang-Mills case. So perhaps we find some similar phenomenon in ABGM theory. And also, we're interested in whether the quantum corrections are basically of the right sign to indicate that they will go towards strong suppression in the strong coupling limits. Okay, so here is then my naive prescription if I want to compute the free energy. So basically, I write down all the vacuum diagrams, which order by order, and then sum them up, and presumably I get some answer. That's my naive hope, which I already indicated may not work due to these infrared divergences. Okay, but let's try this. So first in flat theory, and then we have all the supersymmetry still there. So what happens is that you get should I use this? Okay, so you have So at the leading order, you do the one loop correction. So you have scalars plus fermions. And then due to supersymmetry, you actually have a cancellation here. So the free energy vanishes in the flat case, which is what we expect. Then it's actually a little bit interesting what happens with the gluons and the ghosts. Because they have no net contribution to the free energy, but the details why they don't have any net contribution is a little bit different depending on what gauge you choose. So what people usually do when they do these thermal computations is that they use Coulomb gauge, and then one advantage is that both gluons and ghosts are non-propagating, so they actually contribute by zero plus zero, which is zero, which is good. But then there is also, you can also imagine doing this in Lorentz gauge, and then I thought it was interesting that you actually get non-vanishing contributions, but they are equal but opposite in sign. So the net contribution is zero again, but for different reasons. Okay, so this was in effect theory. So now let's compactify the time direction, which is what we need to do to actually do this, find the object that we're really after, the true free energy. And this now breaks both supersymmetry and conformal invariance. I mean, the compactification introduces some scaling, the radius, which is the inverse temperature. So we no longer have either supersymmetry or conformal invariance. And then basically what we need to remember is that along this compactified direction we have different boundary conditions for different fields. So in particular the fermions are anti-periodic along this circle. Okay. And then this also affects the momentum space. So so this is actually a good thing for the fermions, because they will have half integer multiples of some quantity for the momentum, which means there are no infinite problems for them. But the other fields, and in particular the scalars, will have zero modes. We will find some problems. But okay, let's see if this works. So again, this is basically the same formula that I showed you before. Again, I want to add ghosts and fermions. So I have basically the same expression as before, but now I have to take into account this subscript 0 or 1 half, which corresponds to these different boundary conditions which apply for ghosts and fermions. So this now leads to an asymmetry. So these two expressions are not equal in magnitude, so we get some remainder here, which is what we expect. And this was actually also already in the ABGM paper. So this is the one loop result. And this is the result that I want to find corrections to. Okay, so I want to do quantum corrections. So here are the interaction vertices in ABGM theory. So basically, you have a couple of vertices which are four vertices. Then you have four different types of three vertices, and then you also have a six vertex. Okay, so then I just tell you here how you combine which vertices you need to find corrections of various orders. So, for example, if you have one four vertex or two three vertices, you will find two final diagrams compatible by those vertices, and if you get to three group order, you need either one six vertex or two four vertices, or one four vertex and two three vertices, or four three vertices. Okay, so let's try. So first, let's begin with the two group order. I said that you can use either one four vertex. So here are those two diagrams where I use one four vertex. And then you can also use two three vertices, and that's all the other diagrams for the various types of three vertices which exist in ABGM theory. And now what actually happens here, which happens very often in ABGM theory, is that the order lambda correction actually vanishes. And you can see this diagram by diagram. But for example, this first diagram, the vertex itself has a delta function for the gluons, while the gluon has an epsilon tensor in the proper Newton. So you have an epsilon tensor times a form of a delta function in this diagram. Okay, good. So two loop quarters vanished. So let's proceed to three loop quarter. So this is so basically there are many diagrams in this class, but basically I will mostly just keep on showing six vertex as a representative diagram of those computations. And it's actually a good example because you can already see the problem that I indicated. So since the propagator has zero modes in it, when you're summing over, when you're doing the integral, when n is equal to zero, you actually run into these infrared problems. You get an integral which you have to make sense of. So you need to fix this in some way. Okay, so how to fix this? This is by reorganizing perturbation theory in a way which is captured by this thing.
Does the leading order sum to zero?
The
sum of all diagrams is zero.
At three loops, at three loops, it's actually, I mean, I get these divergences and I don't get them to cancel. I actually don't get an answer to three loop order. Do you expect them to cancel?
I'm just wondering what happens at zero temperature. You showed us what happened at
two loops
at zero temperature.
Right.
Or zero.
Right.
And three loops, you're saying they don't cancel anymore.
At three loops, they don't cancel any longer. And at two loops, the thing I showed you is actually valid also at finite temperature because it's a combinatorial element. Why is it valid?
Oh, it's completely zero?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's completely zero, yes. So I'm doing finite temperature from now on, I guess. So the way to regularize it is to do this finite thermal mass. So the thing you do is you compute the scalar, the self energy for the scalars. And then again, you can see I have my favorite example diagram here, which is the sixth vertex, but then there are many other contributions here as well. And then one interesting thing to note here is that already here we are computing the scalar self energy, the thermal mass, but we are doing it by computing diagrams which themselves already depend on the quantity that we're computing, which we need to do because otherwise this diagram would go up due to these loops. Okay, so once we have that answer, we can then sum them up in the conventional geometric series, and we will find the scalar thermal mass. And I just wanted to mention that in two papers from 2009, this scalar self-energy was computed in the flat case of the general momenta by Minahan, Olson, Sachs, and Sieg. Right, but I need to do it now in the not flat case, but when I have a time direction compactified. So this is the regularization method that I'm using. Again, I just want to indicate why this vanishes to one loop order. I already mentioned this diagram, so you have the product of epsilon and delta, so this is why this vanishes. Up here, we could, in principle, have this diagram as well, but then again, the vertex has a delta function in it for the fermions, which means that this will be proportional to the trace of the gamma matrix, all of which are vanishes, all those traces. Okay, and then we have diagrams of this type. And then you have the gluon propagator, that's the epsilon tensor. Then at each vertex, what happens is that the gluon is connected to one factor of momentum going through the going through the scalar line. But so I actually forgot to tell you, but if both of them go, if both of them connect to the loop momentum, then we get two factors qi, qj, and then this combination vanishes. So then what I, well, actually, okay, very good. So I'm telling you here, I also wrote it here, but I think I forgot to say it, that we're supposed to do one function here using the diagrams in the static limits. So what does the static limit mean? It means that we are doing, what we are doing actually amounts to reorganization of perturbation theory, and there is some freedom how we want to do it. And we want to do it in such a way so as to regularize the problematic modes, which is which are exactly the zero modes. So I will use this static limit, which means no external momentum, because that's exactly the mode that we have trouble with. So that means that there is always no momentum going through the external lines. So if this vertex would connect the diagram to an external line, then you have one factor of zero. So then that's the reason why this diagram can have some left. Okay, it's one loop order. So I continue to two loop order, and here is again my favorite example that you always see with six vertex. So basically you do this computation. So for example, due to the structure of the vertex, you always get some combinatorial factor. Then you basically have one factor here which depends on the number of loops that you're doing, so it's basically always the same. And then you have some interval. And what you see here is that we are already using this thermal mass to compute the loops. Okay, so I just have one slide on the importance of the gauge choice, which I already indicated. So this has an effect on when you do these combinatorics and in the loop intervals. So basically what I actually started out to do was what I thought was the simplest, which was the Lorentz gauge. And in Lorentz gauge, the combinatorics is simpler, but on the other hand, you run into problems when you're doing the loop intervals. So what people actually seem to be doing in almost all the literature on thermal field theories is that they go to Coulomb gauge. And one great thing about Coulomb gauge, which I have to admit I really think is great, is that gluons and ghosts are non-propagating, so those diagrams are so you can immediately see that many contributions are zero very easily in that gauge. Okay, so in any case, when you finish the computation, you find some answer for the thermal mass, and as I show you, so I included it here, and it's expressed in terms of this new square. And as I promised you, since the diagrams which determine this mass actually themselves depend on the mass, I actually don't get a nice closed expression for it. I mean, I get a nice closed equation, but an equation which I cannot solve for mu. So I have to be happy with this equation. Okay, and this is actually called the self-consistent treatment that's discussed by the Holker in 1982. In a related paper by Gross, precisely in Jaffa in 1981, they discussed this appearance of a thermal mass as in the context of an implementation of it as screening length. So in that case, I think they discussed three dimensional QCDs, and then they had gluons for which they got this screening phenomenon. So in the Super-Young Mills case, what happened was that you actually got this screening both for scalars and for gluons. And what I get in this case is that I only get it for scalars. Okay, good. So now we have this thermal mass. So let's reboot the calculation again from the beginning and see if it works better this time. So I showed you again the thing that I showed you several times before. I want to add both environments. However, I should now use massive propagators, a propagator with the thermal mass in it. So what I'm secretly doing is actually summing several diodes with arbitrary numbers of instead of this one PI, one particle reducible instructions. Since that's how I derive, that follows from how I derive the thermal mass. So I'm claiming that I'm doing the one loop order computation, but as you can see, actually all orders in lambda are contributing to this computation. So something strange is happening to perturbation theory, and this is why this is called reorganized perturbation theory. Okay, and here there's a reference to Arnold and Tsai, who discussed this reorganization as an IR regulator in QCD. But I think the original papers that I showed you are also helpful to understand about this source. Okay, so this is now in pictures what I'm doing. So if you prefer formulas, here are formulas which correspond exactly to the previous pictures. So again, I have this formula that you saw before, but I'm changing it a little bit every time. So now the contribution from the scalars actually has a dependence on this scalar mass in it, which in turn, this scalar mass in turn actually depends on the coupling constant itself. So there is an undetermined coupling constant dependence in the answer now. And the reason is that when I do the one loop computation for the scalars, I'm using propagators with this thermal mass in them.
So fermions don't get thermal mass?
Fermions actually don't get thermal mass, and the reason is that they have antiperiodic boundary conditions, so they don't have any zero modes, and that's why you don't have any trouble with them. So it's actually not necessary for them to.
Can you remind why it was antiperiodic? It was your choice, but why did you make this?
It's by the temperature, you don't have a choice.
You don't have a choice.
Oh. It was just an S1, you would have spin structures and you would have a choice.
But in flat space, you would have introduced some kind of mass for those terms as well, or for the fermions, or would a supersymmetry have taken care of all the infrared divergences?
Right. No, I think in the flat case, actually, by supersymmetry, you got away. So.
Okay.
So suppose now that I actually... Okay, so here I show again... here is just the expression, so the question is what is actually... if you do these integral plots, what do you actually... What is the answer? So the answer is here. So here is the free energy, and you get an answer where you actually have an explicit dependence on this thermal mass, and the thermal mass itself is not completely determined, but it's determined by this equation which I showed you, which is a transcendental equation. So there is no good solution to it. But if for very very small lambda, you can approximate the answer by this expression here. So there are some. So here is the ABJM answer, which was already in the ABJM paper, and here is then the correction that I computed, the approximate answer for the correction that I computed.
N squared of y, it must be proportional to t squared, isn't it? What are the other mass scales in the problem?
Like the n squared, I can show you. N squared is exactly proportional to the t squared here. And then I, just to make it easy to handle, I also introduce some other notation, some mu, which is actually dimensionless. But you're right. Okay, so now when. When I worked a lot and got this answer, I just wanted to pause a little bit and make a few comments about the answer. So First of all, there is a huge relief immediately because lambda is small, so log lambda is negative. So this is actually on the other side. So the contribution is on the right order to make this start to vanish when you go to higher and higher, to larger and larger lambda. So this is the answer that I was expecting, and this is the answer that I'm getting. So this is good. Another comment here is that suppose perturbation theory would actually have worked, then I would have expected the first, the two-loop answer to be over lambda, the three-loop answer to be over lambda squared, and so on. However, since log lambda is large, this term, lambda squared, log lambda cube, is actually somewhere between two and three-loop order. So in the superior mean space, Vasquez also called this a two and a half loop order result, which I think is somehow nice because it indicates that you should be careful and remember that where this comes from. Okay, and then I have one last comment that I wanted to mention about this, and this is that already in 2007, so this is before ABGM. Gayot and Dean had a paper where they studied lots of classes of three-dimensional Chern-Simons matter theories. They had less supersymmetry, but still they were a precursor to the developments which happened later. And in their paper they did lots of things, and for example one thing they did was to compute the free energy for these theories, and they get exactly the same dependence on lambda, which I think is a good thing, because I think the lambda dependence is strongly dependent on the dimension of the field theory that you're considering. It's not completely the same thing that they computed, or it's actually a different thing, because it's less supersymmetry. They did it in the abelian case, and they used graph integral techniques. But still, they got the same lambda dependence for their answer. Okay, so here I'm actually not using the approximate answer, but I'm using the full equation that I derived to use. So this is a numerical plot that I did using Mathematica. So what you can see is that it looks very good in the sense that it turns in the right direction, and it indicates that it is plausible to believe that there is a spoofing population to the strong coupling result. Where the free energy goes to zero, and this was the result obtained by Kleber and Satin already long ago. The strong coupling result. Okay, so
what theory was that you were comparing the strong coupling of which?
So it's in the ADS 4 CFT3 context. So in this, the gravity duel was known for a long time.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And that's applicable for the strong coupling answers. And that's the strong coupling answer. So what I now did was the weak coupling answer, and also included the quantum corrections which go in the right direction to match with the strong coupling result, which is why I'm happy with my result. Okay, so I just wanted to, now when I have completed the computation, I just wanted to mention a few, comment on a few differences between superior means and ABGM, or if there are similarities. So, I mean, so for example, in superior means, I mentioned that there was an order number correction, and only then did the non-analytical correction appear, and it was an order number to 3 hertz. In ABGM, for some reason, it seems that the order lambda corrections very often vanish. This happens in this computation as well. So actually, already the first non-vanishing correction exhibits this strange non-analytical behavior, where the exact non-analytical dependence on lambda is a little bit different. Okay, and then I also mentioned that I had to use this self-consistent treatment, while in the superior means case, it was actually more straightforward because they did one loop diagrams and they were all regular, and they could compute them and sum them up and get a nice closed expression for the thermal mass. Okay, so this is just to summarize my three my free energy computation. So again, basically what I did was that I found the first non-vanishing quantum correction of the true free energy. The correction is non-analytic in lambda, and approximately on this order with its log lambda standards. And also one reason why I'm happy with the result is that basically I got the right sign. So the sign is the correct one to indicate that there is a smooth interpolation to the stroke mechanism. Can I just ask for how long I'm supposed to speak? Is it 1 hour?
It was 1 hour, and you started at about
5 minutes. Okay. Okay, so I just wanted to mention a little bit about correlation functions, about chiral primary operators as well, because this is something that I've been working on more recently, and this is work in progress. But I still just wanted to mention it, because one motivation here is that you saw in the free energy computation that I think it was a good result, but we have this log lambda, which means that the range of validity is really small. We have to require that log lambda is really, really is large, which due to the log means that lambda has to be really, really, really small for this to be valid. So the range of validity is not that impressive. So it could be interesting to look at some other quantity which also exhibits the same scaling, but which doesn't suffer from these infrared divergences, which will enable us to do a full, get a perturbative computation with a longer range. So the thing, right, and in this context, I just wanted to mention some other recent developments which are also important in this context. So, for example, in August, there was, in this context, an extremely amazing paper by Dukkan, Mahindu, and Putro, because what they did was they did look at ABGM theory. They did not look at the free energy, but some other partition function. But for that partition function, they actually found an expression where they could take the full weak and strong coupling limits and find exactly the right answers in both limits. So that was a really good result. I wanted to comment on some points here why I still think my computation is a good complement to this computation. So, for example, I think it's really helpful for them that they have a lot of supersymmetry, which leads to lots of cancellations. And it's also not the true free energy. They are doing this computation on a free sphere, so it's some kind of partition function with the same, with similar scaling behavior. But, for example, since they are using a compact space, they have no trouble with the infrared divergences in this case. And then there was also a follow-up paper by Harrison, Teodoro, Kuzman, and Ciliano, where they did these computations for less, in a similar way, but with class of theories which have less supersymmetry. Okay, so about the correlation functions, about all kind of primary operators, I just, again, I wanted to start out with a slide about some history of what is happening in the Supermese case. And then the first thing that happened is that in a paper by Lee, Limbala, Rangamani, and Seibert, they actually did the full, this is all valid for Supermese now. So they did the computation for weak and strong coupling, they found exactly the same answer, and they conjectured that okay, these correlation functions are probably then independent of lambda. And this was later confirmed by a loop corrections computation. But it was still not clear why this was exactly happening.
You mean three-point functions?
Sorry, three-point functions, yes. Yes, okay. Thank you very much for the comment. So it's, what I write here is actually wrong. So it should be three-point functions here. Yeah. And then there were some developments which actually led to a greater understanding of why this is true. So Trilligator and Schema show that this is something to do with supersymmetry, because if there is a certain bonus symmetry, then they show that this implies that certain quantities, for example, quantities studied by Howard West, are actually invariant. And then Eden, Howe, and West showed that this bonus symmetry actually applies precisely to these types of correlation functions, which is valid for supergravity on ADS5. So this then means that there is an understanding of why this is happening, and it's also clear that it's only true for ADS5. So for the case that I'm looking at ADS4, this is not valid, and in fact it's expected that there will be animals on the coupling also. But in ADS5, this worked. Okay, but let's go to the ABGM theory and see what the kind of primary operator looks like. So in this case, I mentioned that this is the SU4 multiplet that I'm working with. So to get the chiral primary operators, you do you take a product of y and y daggers with some coefficient which is symmetric in upper and lower indices, and what traces between upper and lower indices vanish. So once you have that, you can then consider various correlation functions of these operators. So for example, length one operators of this type, and here it's supposed to be the prefactor is omitted, but it's supposed to be there and make them higher primary operators. Okay, so it's clear what this will look like at tree level, both the two and sequence functions, because the propagators are known. And the image structure here, if you have A bar, A can only connect to B bar, and so on. So all the image structures appear. And you can also see if you do the Fourier transform to momentum space, you have this actually looks like a one loop integral, even though you're at tree level. Okay, and similarly for the 3-point function. Here you can actually imagine in the planar limit going either this way or the other way. So you have two different index structures. You can have A, B bar, or A, C bar going that way. Okay, so that's the tree level system. So let's again look at loop corrections. Basically what I want to compute are the numbers C and D applying to corrections to the 2 and 3-point functions. And okay, since I did the free energy computation, I have some experience with doing these quantum corrections. So basically the setup is partly similar. So here is just a general setup of what I want to compute. So again, for similar reasons as before, the one loop corrections will vanish. So I only have two loop corrections corresponding to the various sets of vertices, which give rise to two corrections. And here is just one thing that I find it convenient to not include one-way corrections here in these expressions, but do them separately. So what I mean is, corrections which only include one single leg. Because here I can actually, these are, if you look at the full set of diagrams and combinatorics, this is a very, very small part of the full calculation that you need to do, but it's still nice to get some stuff out of the way. And here I can actually directly use this tensor, which Minham also Sykes and Sieg found. Okay, so then what remains is the bulk of the work, which is to compute 2 and also 3-leg computations, so 3-point function. So basically, first I do the combinatorics, then I do the loop integrals. And here are the conditions which apply to the procedure writing down the final diagrams. So I write down the final diagrams, which are planar, connected, and which have no tangles. And also, in the flat theory, there are no self-contractions. They vanish in dimensional regularization. While you remember that in the free energy computation, there was actually computed contributions from self-contractions as well. And in that case, I also have the one particle reducibility condition. Okay, so in principle, I can do this without caring of what type of vertices I have, but then, so these are in a sense topological conditions, but then the final condition is that I have to make sure that these final diagrams that I find are actually realizable in AVGM, in the sense that I need to have vertices where gluons connect to gluons, for example. So for previous, these first four conditions, I guess, I don't need to care about that. Okay, and here are just some comments on what I expect to happen in this computation. So I'm hoping I get something with a larger range of validity. On the other hand, there are both similar and unique challenges. And for example, one thing which is really important is that in the free energy, there were actually no contributions from the 3-3-3-3 vertices, because I did it in the static limit, and those contributions to the scalar self-energy always happen to be proportional to one, at least one factor for external momentum, which was really great, because that meant that they vanished. But I don't expect any such simplification in this case. And this is a huge class of diagrams. Okay, it's also more difficult here because I'm working with composite operators, and I do have chiral primary operators, which is important to be sure that I have the right scaling for the correlation functions. And also I know that the divergent piece will cancel for such operators because there are no anomalous dimensions. But I still need to find the finite piece. And the finite piece is, again, also more difficult to find than the divergent piece. Okay, so I give you some example diagrams, the 6 vertex and the 4 vertex, and perhaps it's not so interesting to go through all the details for them, but this is also a work in progress. But suppose that I finally get the answer, and then what I told you is that I get these coefficients C and D for the quantum corrections to the 2 and 3 point functions. And then the common, it's possible to, so the reason I'm doing 2 types of correlation functions is because there is an ambiguity in terms of normalization of the operators. But if I have 2 of them, I can find a common normalization in this way, which then comes out to be 3C minus 2D. And if this is supposed to vanish at strong coupling, the prediction is that 3C minus 2D is less than 0. So I have basically done all the combinatorics, but I haven't finished all the loop integrals. So the partial result I have so far is I have the null sign to the plus sign, but the prediction is for the full result, so hopefully this will resolve itself. So just to summarize again what I did, I mean basically I was interested in this strange suppression of degrees of freedom in AVGM theory at strong coupling, and I wanted to see if it was possible to understand it from a weak coupling point of view, and I studied various objects and completed this free energy computation, which actually turned out to support this statement. And then eventually it could be interesting to perhaps, if I want to continue doing these things, it could be interesting to perhaps study how wrapping interactions work in terms of various lengths of the operators, or go to higher quantum corrections, or also study non-planar corrections. Okay, so thank you very much for listening.
Sorry, I don't understand your 3C minus 2D.
Okay.
Well, what does it? What matters is the normalization of the 3-point function when the 2-point function is normalized to 1 or some ratio which is independent of the normalization. What sense does it make?
Right. So you can actually formulate it in different ways. So either you can do it in the way I think you indicated, that you say that, okay, let's do the 2-point function is normalized to 1, and then you find the 3-point function. And it should be of some definite scaling. There is another equivalent formulation of exactly the same statement, which is that there is one normalization for operators such that all n-point functions scale in the same way at strong coupling, and in particular, they scale as lambda to the power minus 1/2 also the two-point function. But I agree with you, I talked to other people, and other people also complained about exactly the same thing and said that's a confusing way to mean it. Normalize the two-point function to 1, and then do the three-point function. Both viewpoints are equal.
One more thing.
Yeah.
Is this none, this fact that the three-point function is not is renormalized,
right,
contrary to n plus 4, is it related to the existence of this function h of lambda in ABJM? And can you infer what h of lambda is from this computation?
Okay, I think that's a really interesting question, because it's true. I mean, I call my entire talk scaling properties of ABJM theory, and as you know much better than me, there is this h of lambda function appearing when you do these integrability computations and manuals. So in principle, there could be some relation, but if there is a relation, I don't know the exact relation. But it's true, there could be some relation.
So, confused by the response to the first question.
Okay.
I'm not an expert, but if I chose E to remove the scaling in your two-point function,
right,
then I'm going to get a scaling where the coefficient changes. I mean, it's the same coefficient, but it changes sign. So, I'm not sure what we're looking for now. I mean, rather than in the three-point function, rather than 3C minus 2D, you're going to have D minus 3 half C. So you...
Right.
So I'm not
right. No, I mean, the statement will be different if you do it in different choices of normalization. And again, perhaps I should apologize, because you are not the first ones who actually complain about my... I mean, I think basically it's the two-point function, which some people... I mean, the canonical normalization is to have the two-point function equal to 1, right?
Okay.
So the only thing here was that I thought that, okay, it's actually nice to have a normalization in which all n-point functions behave as lambda to the power minus 1/2, which is the convention that I'm using. But I agree it may be confusing.
No, but didn't Rob just show that it is not equivalent? It's the opposite.
I think I have to look at it more. I mean, I think it works, but okay. Give me some time.
Okay.
Is it known if this suppression and strong coupling of the degrees of freedom exists in theories, turn time in series of less supersymmetry, even in non-supersymmetric theory? Or is this special to the
theory? I mean, it's true for ABGM, and there are also characteristics in the behaviors for the other theories, which are not exactly the same, but I mean, there is a known scaling behavior. So, for example, this paper that I mentioned recently by Tosinirono and Buffo, they did it for other theories with less supersymmetry, and they got some scaling which was a little bit different.
It also decays at strong coupling.
I believe it also decays at strong coupling. Not necessarily in the same way and with the same coefficient.
No further questions? Let's thank Michael again. Very nice.